Mug meeting for February 10th, 2009. So, just before I get right into the presentation, I'd like to start with disclaimers. I don't know. I must have been a lawyer in a previous life or something. This is not the first time we do a presentation on firewalls, so you might be wondering why we're doing another one. It turns out it's a topic we visited a lot many years ago, and so one of the reasons it kind of made sense to do it again is, first of all, there are a lot of new people who probably haven't seen the presentations we did, like in 2000, 2001, and thereabouts. Also, the technology has changed. When I was about halfway into the prep for this presentation, I actually went back and revisited some of the mug meeting archives, and for one of them, there was actually the slides available, and I looked through it, and yeah, sure enough, a lot of the technology has changed since then, and some of the books that had been recommended at that meeting that I had on in my library at work are now mostly irrelevant. Because, again, the software has changed since then. So there's another reason. The other disclaimer I like to say is I'm not an expert on this. In my work, I am responsible for managing Unix server systems of various flavors. So I have to use this stuff. I do a lot of stuff to do with network administration, which includes security, but I'm by no means a security expert. So take what I say with a grain of salt. All right. I'm going to assume that you have a basic knowledge of networks and what network firewalls are, so I'm just going to go through these first few slides quite quickly. But typically when we talk about a firewall, we're usually referring to a dedicated box that sits between two parts of the network. Usually it mediates between the internet and an internal network. And that can either be a dedicated box or it can be just a computer system running some software. But usually it's a dedicated function. So you've got one box sitting there separating the network out. And it blocks undesirable traffic in one or both directions. Okay, so this is the type of diagram you're probably used to seeing for a firewall. So you got your big bad wolf internet out here, and you got the big brick wall over here, and inside here you got your white virgin wool sheep that are all, you know, good little corporate citizens, and they can do no wrong, and bad wolf out here, and never the twain shall meet. Well, it's usually not that simple, because your sheep start clamoring for services out in Wolfville, so you have to start punching holes through the firewall to let them out, to get at those. And then the sheep decide, well, they want to set up an internet store, so you have to set up a demilitarized zone where you're going to run your web server, DNS, email server, and whatever else, so that they can sell their wool online. And so now all of a sudden you've got more holes in there, and the wolf decides to be clever and sends an email out, and it looks like it's a greeting card that says I love you, and one of the trusting sheep inside just opens it, and all of a sudden the wolf blitzer virus is let loose on your whole network. So that usually doesn't work very well. So what we really need is something that goes a little better than just a single firewall at the network border. The main flaw with this is you have no protection against internal attacks, whether it's malicious or just inadvertent, like virus attacks and that sort of thing. Your DMZ hosts, that's the demilitarized zone on the network, it's hard to protect those if you have to leave them open to a whole bunch of for a whole bunch of services. And when you're dealing with complex real world networks, again, it's typically not as simple as that scenario I showed on the previous slide. So if you're looking at, for instance, the U of M campus network, where there's a whole bunch of servers scattered throughout the network, and pretty much any professor, even on their desktop machine, may want to run some service and have it visible on the outside. So there's not a lot of firewalling you can actually do at the network border to protect some of those machines inside when everyone wants their machines to be visible. Also, when you're dealing with very large networks, there's performance issues. And the more complex your firewall filtering, typically the slower it is. And if you're dealing with large volumes of traffic, things can bog down. So again, the example we have at the U of M, our main firewall system can't afford to do a lot of really fancy stuff. And so they tend to do very minimal filtering, which means most of our boxes inside are mostly open to the outside world. So what we would really need in an ideal world is like a firewall for each machine configured individually. Crazy idea, right? Well, maybe not. It turns out most systems nowadays, pretty much any flavor of Unix, has firewall software that comes with it. And typically that's some sort of in-kernel packet filter. You want it in the kernel so that it's efficient. It's going to have to examine all the traffic in and possibly out of that computer. And so you want something that's going to really work quickly so it doesn't slow you down. So it's in the kernel, but through user mode, you need some way of configuring this thing. And usually you've got either a command line interface or you've got some configuration files that you edit. And if you're lucky, you might have a fancy GUI front end to it. And at its most basic, what you do is you set up a list of rules that will match all some or all of this information, which would be the IP source or destination address, source or destination port, the protocol, TCP/IP, the direction of the traffic. Is it coming into your box or going out? The interface it's on, if you happen to have a box with multiple interfaces, and so on. And then once you've got these rules set up, well, you want to set them up to either allow particular types of desirable traffic through or just drop particular packets. And I've got all these words here. That's just different firewall software uses different vocabulary, and these are all kind of synonymous. So allow, accept, pass, permit, same idea in general for those. Block, deny, drop. Essentially what that says is this particular packet is going to go no further, and you're just going to ignore it. It's like you're just throwing it in the garbage. Now, in some cases, you don't want to just throw away the packet because it can cause some weird issues protocol-wise. Sometimes what you want to do instead is reject a packet, which usually causes something like an ICMP return. So the other end knows that this packet didn't get through. And in some cases, you want one type of behavior. In other cases, you want the other. So again, typically their software gives you a choice between those. Early firewall software, like early firewalls, were stateless. That meant that each packet was looked at individually without any prior knowledge of previous traffic that had come through and without any thought to what traffic was going to come through after. And it turns out that that's not always the best way to configure things. It can be a little limiting to do that. So a lot of firewalls now have what's called stateful operation. So they remember something about previous patterns, and that will influence the decisions on future traffic. So that'll make a little bit more sense as I go on with the explanations. So typically for state information, there's two things we need to be concerned with under the general heading of connection tracking. The first one is essentially what I refer to as state tracking. And that's kind of at its most basic form. What you want to do is you want to remember a particular type of desirable traffic going in one direction. It might be outbound. You want to remember these five bits of information about it. You want to remember the address for both the source and the destination, the port for both the source and the destination, and also the protocol. And those five bits of information is essentially what makes a particular traffic flow unique. And so if you remember that, when you see other packets that match that, or with the direction reversed, you know, oh, this is part of that connection. So typically, once you've remembered the first of those in a series, any of the others that match that pattern, you just say, this is part of that connection, I'm going to allow it. And that's still not enough, because you sometimes have to deal with protocols that will issue broadcasts, and then the traffic that comes back as a response to that broadcast isn't going to quite match this. So you could do things like fuzzy matches, but that might not be quite so easy. Turns out a lot of the state tracking mechanisms that I've seen don't do that kind of fuzzy matching. So anything that's broadcast-based is a little bit problematic. There's also the notion of related connections. And that's a little bit more tricky, but let me illustrate that with an example. That's kind of the obvious example, but there are a few others too. So FTP, one of the classic protocols of the internet, and it's one that's not about to disappear anytime soon. Turns out in the good old days, most FTP servers implemented what was called active FTP. So a client connects through port 21 to a server and issues commands on that port. And typically the commands will be things like get a file or put a file. When it does that, typically one of the things that the client passes along is a port number to be used for the data connection. So separate from the control connection, there's a data connection that's established. And in active FTP, the server would actually initiate that connection back to the client, all right? So the client is saying, I want to get this file, and it gives it a port number. The server makes that connection back. That became problematic when we started putting our client systems behind NAT boxes and firewalls and various things like that. It made it kind of difficult for this connection back to the client. Turns out that FTP servers had something else called passive mode in there, which in the early days was kind of a weird feature that was really seldom used. I think one of the initial uses for it was to allow a server to actually delegate the data connection to another box, actually, with a different address. So the information contained not only a port number, but an IP address, so that you could potentially tell the client, okay, yeah, your data is ready, go and get it over here. But it turns out that because active FTP was a real problem when you would put a firewall or a NAT box here behind with the client behind it, most servers now start using passive FTP by default, and most clients actually request that that it be a passive mode transfer. The way that works is the client still starts by requesting a connection on port 21 as usual, but when it's going to do the transfer, the server actually gives it the IP address and the port number, and then the client initiates the data connection as well. And now we're dealing with sort of a random high port number. It's not a well-known port on both ends, and it's the client initiating that connection. This becomes a problem for firewalls, because how do you let holes through the firewall for these numbers when you don't know what they are ahead of time? And if you don't allow it, how is the client going to be able to open that connection to the server? So that's our problem there with FTP. Turns out TFTP has a similar problem, and there are lots of other, whoops, I better watch my distance here. There are lots of other protocols that have similar types of issues. I mentioned broadcasts earlier. Turns out one practical example where that comes into play is if you're using, say, a Samba server, and you're using NetBIOS name services within there, that issues broadcasts. And so you're going to have a problem with firewall rules matching that. Other examples of services that use related connections on other port numbers, the Amanda backup service, where the backup server actually initiates a connection to the clients to request that they make themselves ready for a backup, and then the client sends the data to the server over another port that the server has told it is available for it. Protocols like IRC, people that are into telephony, voice over IP, there's the SIP protocols have a similar issue like that. Multimedia protocols, peer-to-peer tunneling, all of these are potentially problematic. And not to mention, NAT just kind of plays a number on firewalls as well. Okay, now I'm going to look at three different firewall systems. And they're not really in any particular order other than I think I decided to start with this one because it's kind of the oldest and the simplest. And then after looking at this one, I'll look at another one called IPFW, which is the one that is included in macOS. And I'll end off with NetFilter, or IP tables as it's usually referred to, which is the Linux-based solution. And so this one, IPFilter, it's probably the most portable of all of these. It's available for Linux, actually, for pretty much all of the BSD-based systems and lots of other Unix flavors as well. It's been ported to Solaris, and starting with Solaris 10, Sun includes it in as a supported package. And so if you're running Solaris 10 or Open Solaris, it's kind of the logical choice. The thing with most of these, as I mentioned earlier, because they sit in kernel, you need to have special kernel modules. And so if it doesn't come bundled with your system, it's going to be a fairly ugly job to get it into the system potentially. So it's usually best to just go with what is natively available for your system. So for Solaris, it's kind of the natural choice. The way you configure it is you put all your rules into one configuration file, and all of those rules get read in by a command, and they get loaded into the kernel driver. The weird thing about it is if you have multiple potential matching rules, it's the last one in sequence that actually counts. So that's, yeah, it's the only one of the three that I looked at that works that way. Yep, that's correct. Yeah. Essentially, what that implies, there's an exception, which I'll get to in just a second. But yeah, typically, your whole list of rules is one sequential list, and it's going to check through every one of those rules. And then the last one that it found that matched is the one that's going to apply. And so, yeah, it's doing an exhaustive linear search every time. Now, since that's inefficient, typically what you end up seeing is a lot of your rules use this quick keyword. And that says, if you match this rule, stop right there. You don't need to go any further down the list. So it's kind of a way of breaking the normal sequence and making things a little bit more efficient. Okay. Within Solaris, there's no GUI that's actually provided. This is Solaris. Their attitude seems to be GUIs are for end users. If you're a sysadmin, you're happy with the command line. But if you do want a GUI, there's one called FW Builder. I can't make any recommendations because I haven't even tried it. But I know it is available for a number of different firewall systems, actually. But someone has actually done a port of it to Solaris, so you can get it as probably a precompiled binary that you can just install under Solaris. All right. Rule syntax. This might look a little cumbersome, but it's actually probably one of the simplest ones in terms of rule syntax. You start with the keyword block or pass, depending on whether you want to allow that packet through or block it. You specify the direction that it applies to, input or output. That has to be supplied. And then pretty much the rest of this is optional. You can say that you want that traffic logged to a log device. There's that keyword quick that I mentioned, which will tell it to stop the search at that point. You can optionally specify an interface using the keyword on. You can specify the protocol, which is TCP or UDP or ICMP. Or as you can see from an example here, you can actually say TCP/UDP and it'll apply to either one of those. For your addresses, you can either use the keyword all that says match all addresses and ports, or you can specify this from to sequence where you have from, you have an address specification, optionally port equals, and then a port specification, and then the keyword to, and then you repeat the same thing for the destination. You can match on particular flags. I'll show an example of that later. There's with certain options, and that's kind of a little bit more esoteric, and I don't know if any of my examples go into that. So, we'll just skip that for now. And finally, there's this thing called keep state, and that ties into that state table mechanism I was talking about earlier. So here's a few simple examples. And these three rules give you a very basic, very rudimentary firewall, but it pretty much does the job. First of all, there's a rule that says any traffic on LO0, which is your loopback interface, you want to pass that. And we just say quick because once we match that rule, we don't need to know anything else. And we're matching on all addresses. So anything on the loopback address, let it through. And then here's kind of a default rule that says anything on this interface, which typically that's going to be our external interface to the outside world, anything on that interface we're going to block, but there's no quick on this, so we still go to the next rule. And this one says anything going out, we will pass it for protocols TCP and UDP. We're saying from any to any, and then we're saying keep state over here. What that does is for any traffic that goes out, it's going to record the state information, which is those five bits of information I mentioned, source, destination, address and port, and the protocol. And so any traffic now coming in, okay, by default would be blocked, but if it matches the state table, it's going to go through. And turns out with IP filter, the state table checking is done before you even go through your list. And if you match the state table, it doesn't have to go through the list. It's an automatic acceptance of that packet. All right. Now that prior example was maybe a little bit simplistic. It didn't do anything about ICMP, for instance. And there were a lot of other things that were not optimal. So here's just slightly augmented a set of rules. So we're doing things now. Here's where the with comes in. This is saying that any short packets, which aren't properly constructed packets, we're just going to block them because they're probably bogus. IP options is a particular thing that for normal traffic is never used. But people who like to forge packets like to use these things. So typically that's bogus again, so we'll block it. We're also logging those. And here's our loopback. We're now passing not only inbound, but outbound as well, without keeping state. Otherwise, this rule would have applied, and we would be keeping state. But we don't really need the state information on there, so this makes it go a little quicker. Now, for the public network, we're going to block everything not explicitly allowed. I've got this one commented out because I was just testing this, but the sample that I took this from, which is available on the internet, they were by default blocking all traffic in both directions and then just making exceptions. So some of those exceptions are ICMP. Okay. So now we're allowing it in both directions and keeping the state, which again kind of seems pointless if you're allowing it in both directions. But the reason for that is you might decide that you don't want to allow all incoming stuff. So you might comment out this rule and then you'll have this one, but you'll want to keep the state because when you send out ICMP packets, you will want to see the replies to those. And so the state table is what's going to save you there. And then finally, this is for all your other outbound traffic, TCP and UDP. This is the same rule we saw earlier. And finally, if you want this machine to have some sort of incoming services allowed, then you have to explicitly allow those as well. Because so far, all we're doing is we're allowing traffic out, but we're blocking everything coming in. So here, I hope you can all read that line at the bottom. This is a little bit more wordy as a rule, but it's essentially it's saying is for any inbound traffic, we'll pass it so long as the protocol is TCP. The ports we don't particularly, or the addresses we don't particularly care about, but we want the destination port number to equal 22, which is SSH. And then here's the flags thing. We're saying any packet that has the S flag, that's short for SYN, that's essentially when you first go to establish a connection. The very, very first packet that goes through has the SYN flag set. And so what we're doing is we're matching on that, and then we're keeping state information. And so the rest of the flow for that particular connection is now going to match in the state table. So we're going to allow the replies through, and we're also going to allow traffic back in that is part of that same connection. Okay, I mentioned broadcast-based services earlier, like NetBIOS. Well, unfortunately, our state table mechanism in IP filter is a little too limited, so it's not going to do what we need here. It doesn't do any sort of fuzzy matching on the broadcast addresses. So if we don't do anything special, the replies are not going to match the state table, and so they're going to be blocked. And so what we have to do is essentially a set of three rules like this. First of all, what we want to do is we want to allow in any UDP traffic from, this is just the local net, so you would of course adjust that to whatever's appropriate for you. So any traffic originating on your local network we put any address here because it might be a broadcast or it might be directed to one of your interfaces. You might have more than one as well. On port 137, which is the port that NetBIOS uses for name services, before I get to this rule, I'll show this one. This is the outbound one. We're saying anything outbound we want to allow on port UDP for, again, any addresses where the destination port is 137. That's basically letting you send out requests. And the replies to those, again, you're probably going to send that out as a broadcast. The reply is going to come back directly to you. It's going to come back with the source port equal to 137. So that's what this rule matches here. So it's a little ugly, but it works. FTP, a little bit more tricky. Remember what I was saying before about the active versus passive. Okay, active is a problem for the clients, but it's usually not a problem for the server as long as they can do outbound port 20, which is the data well-known port number. But nowadays, most FTP servers have to implement passive mode because the clients expect it. So how do we do it? Essentially, what we need to do is somehow configure our FTP service to restrict the port range that it's going to use for those passive connections to some particular known range. Now, you may be tempted to set this to a very small range, so that someone trying to hack into there is not going to just guess the port number. But it turns out that that isn't a good idea for a couple reasons. First of all, if you do have a very small range, they can figure that out by trying to connect to your server and trying to start a data transfer. Also, it will affect your server's ability to send out data on those data ports, because those ports get used up essentially one per connection. So it's not only one per client, but if one client is repeatedly requesting files one after another, it's going to probably use a different data port each time. And since they don't time out right away, like after you close a connection, it goes into kind of a wait state for a while before that port is reused again. So you need a large enough range. Also, if you're just trying to keep out hackers, a larger range probably helps because it reduces their chances of actually guessing what port you're going to be using. Probably more information than you needed to know, but anyway, so this is how in VSFTP you would specify this in its config file. And then in the IPF.conf file, you would need a couple rules that look something like this. And so you're saying you want to allow in TCP traffic from any address to, and this is a specific notation. This is literally what you would put is this host within angle brackets. And what that does is it matches any of the valid addresses for this host. We don't need to worry about broadcasts in this case, so we just need to match our actual addresses. But using this notation is a little bit more portable, I guess, than hard coding the address of the machine. And if you happen to have a machine with multiple addresses, multiple interfaces, this is the only convenient way to specify them all. That would be tempting, but no. The way the syntax works for this, if you want to specify the port, you need to specify this whole string, starting with the from all the way to here. Because this port specification is part of our destination specification. So, and the port option is specified after the address. So you need the keyword to, you need to specify something as an address. So this is kind of the best way to do it. All right. And you also need to specify the from. You can't put just the from or the to. It's from address information to address information as one block. It's just the way their syntax works. So now what we're doing is we're saying that on port 21, which is our control port for FTP, again, we're using the flags S to match that very first incoming request on that. And then the state table is what's going to allow the rest of that connection to go through. And then this second rule is what's going to match our port range that we've specified here. And it's using this rather cumbersome syntax over here. That's essentially saying for any port that falls between these two numbers, not including those are the outer bounds essentially. So it's everything in between those. So kind of a quirk about the syntax of this one. Okay. Once you've specified your rules in that file, the only thing left to do is, well, you want to make sure you have the software. So these are the package names, just in case they didn't come pre-installed as part of your Solaris install. They are available as part of the system, so just install those packages. You edit your ipf.conf file, which is stored in a directory, etc. IPF, and then Solaris now has this new service administrator feature starting with Solaris 10, I believe. Or that may have come in Solaris 9, I'm not sure. Anyway, now rather than using init.d startup files, you go through this svcadm thing. And so you tell it enable /IP filter. That's basically just a partial string match against the full specification, which is a little bit longer and uglier. But that's all you really need to worry about is /IP filter. And that enables the service. And it's going to cause it to read this file. And you're good to go. Your firewall's in effect. Typically, as you're setting this up and trying it out, you're going to go in repeatedly and edit this file. So this is kind of a loop here. Iteratively, you're gonna keep tweaking this. Well, once the service is enabled, you just want to reload the file. Typically, the way you do that is with the refresh command. But there's also a way of calling the method script directly, and then you can be a little bit more selective about what you're reloading. If you really just want to reload the ipf.conf, there's an option called reipf that lets you do that. It turns out IPFilter also has a sort of a companion program called IPNAT, which, as the name implies, does NAT stuff. And it has a separate configuration. And if you do a full refresh, it's kind of reloading everything. And so you might want to do this just for efficiency or whatever. Okay. Once you've got it running, you might want to just check up on things. There's an IPF stat command that lets you do things like check the hit counts against the rules. You can get a summary with just the -h option, or by specifying an I or an O or both, you can get a list of the rules, the input and the output rules, and it'll give you the hit count on a per rule basis, which is quite useful if you want to see if your rules are actually working. Or if things are not working correctly, you might be able to see, oh, okay, my traffic's all being blocked over here, so I need to put in an exception to the rules, that kind of thing. The N option is potentially useful if you're specifying the I or the O. It will just number the rules, so it might help you find them in the sequence. But since you're not really putting sequence numbers in the file anyway, it may not be of use, but it kind of helps you in just figuring out the order of things. Other things you might want to do with this is view the state table. Again, you can get just a summary of statistics, or with the S and the L option, you can get a list of all the rules that are dynamically in the state table. And this changes over time. There's also this kind of neat mode that they've got in there with the minus T option. You guys have probably all seen the top command that lets you list processes, and it shows which ones are the top CPU users. Essentially, this does the same thing. It lists your state table and is constantly refreshing it. And you can sort it in different orders. You can sort it either by expiry time or other information. I think even the hit count, so you can see which rules are in the state table are actually matching the most often. Logging is a little bit odd in this one. It doesn't actually log directly to a syslog facility. It sets up a log device, which is just a kernel virtual device. And so if you then want to see the log entries, you actually have to have some process that is sitting there monitoring that logging device. And it comes with a command called ipmon that'll do exactly that for you. So it will open that device, look for any new log entries, and then you can just save the output of that to a disk file. Okay, here's a bunch of the resources that I used to compile the previous information, as well as get a good working set of rules for my Solaris systems. The first few are just general things. Start with Wikipedia. It's got some useful summary information and some very good external links as well. The next one is the sort of the official home site for IPfilter. It's a little bit stale now, but it's still the official site. This over here is an IPfilter FAQ, which is actually quite extensive and quite useful. Covers a lot of very esoteric things, including that passive mode FTP example I showed you. Sort of a companion to the FAQ is there's this over here, which is kind of a IPfilter how-to, which if you're just getting started is a useful way. In addition to all of those, I was still kind of stymied with how to get things set up until I came across this particular tutorial, which is actually just a set of slides from a presentation someone named Guido did at BSDCon 2000. And so it's just a series of slides you can go through, and he gives a lot of examples, starting with some very simple stuff, and then he kind of builds on that. So it was quite useful to figure out how to get going. Then I found some Solaris-specific docs. There's a couple over here which are actually at the Sun website. Both of them relate to IPfilter. One of them, I think, was... I can't remember which is which. Gee, how can I keep... how can I not know them apart from these URLs? Anyway, one of them was kind of an overview of IPfilter in general. And then the other one was specifically about the IPfilter service under Solaris, like how to start and stop the service and manage the service. Few other things here. Oh, yeah, this was a neat little tutorial on setting up a firewall using IPfilter. This over here was an example of how to use IPfilter under Solaris. And I think the main reason I included that link is that's the example, that screen I showed with all of those, that's actually just a subset of the stuff that was included in this. And so I thought that was a useful example to start with, and it's actually what I based my live set of firewall rules on. And finally, if you're interested in the GUI, I had mentioned FW Builder. This isn't the official site for FW Builder. It's a SourceForge project. But this is the site where they've got information on the Solaris port of that. Okay. So that was IP filter. Another one now that I'm going to cover. I'm going to go over this more quickly than I did over Solaris because the concepts are really very similar. This is the one that's included in macOS going at least as far back as 10.3. It might have been available earlier, but it started in 10.0? Okay. All right. Thanks. I didn't know that. The oldest system I had to check this on was a 10.3 system. So that's what I put on the slide. All right. And it's also available for FreeBSD. Unlike IP filter, which is very portable and kind of very loosely coupled to the kernel, it just ties in through a packet filter interface. This one's a little bit more intricately tied into BSD-ish systems. And so it's available for macOS because it's BSD-based. It's available for FreeBSD and probably some of the other BSD-based systems. Strangely enough, even though no one has ported it to Linux, someone has ported it to Windows 2000. Gee, I wonder where they got a lot of their new IP code from. Anyway, so there's a WIPFW, which is the Windows port of that. With this one, you can add rules either by individual commands or putting them in config files. Each rule has a rule number, and that's how the order is determined. So you can actually, through the command, just kind of put your rules in any chronological order. But by specifying these rule numbers, you tell it where in the list that rule is applying. And with this one, it's the lower rule number that is the one that counts. So yeah, it's basically a first match type of approach. Strange thing with macOS is depending on which version you have, the GUI is going to be at different places and it's going to have different functionality. There are also third-party GUIs available. Right at the end of this section, there's a link to that, which I'll talk about later. Syntax is similar enough to IP filter that if you've looked at IP filter rules, you can look at these and intuitively know what they're doing. However, it's different enough that if you're used to writing rules for one of them, it's different enough that you're really going to get screwed up. So since this was kind of the last one I learned to do, I actually relied on the GUI to get me going because the syntax was just, yeah, like I said, it's quite similar in some of the words that are used, like you use from and to, but yeah, it's different, you know. Like the protocol is specified before the keyword from, but you don't put the keyword proto there. Port numbers are optional, and they're just following the address. You don't put the port keyword or anything. And so your rules look something like this. So you would say add, and then a number, and then allow or deny. And it allows all of these different synonyms. You can say allow, accept, pass, permit. Or you can say deny drop for packets you don't want. So typically, you use the words allow and deny. You can then say all, which is essentially one of the possible protos. That just matches against all protocols. Then from any to any. So this is basically like that first rule I had on the other slide. This is matching everything on the loopback interface. One of the interesting things here is we're not actually specifying a direction. So this is matching traffic in both directions. It's the only one of the three that I'm going to be looking at tonight where the direction is actually one of our options here. We can specify it, but we don't have to. So in some cases, that's actually nice because if we want symmetric rules for both directions, it just takes one rule. So what we're doing here, this is kind of sort of an analog to those first few rules I had with IP filter. There are a few differences. For instance, here there's this option here called established. That's kind of a interesting difference because IPFW is tied in more intricately into BSD's IP stack, and so it's actually looking at some of the IP state table information from the IP or from the TCP stack in this case. So that already knows which connections are established. So rather than replicate that in a separate state table just for the firewall, we'll just go in and pick out the information we need. Here's a rule for matching SSH in both directions. Here's our rule again for allowing the outbound traffic, and we're going to keep the state. Notice there's a hyphen here. Again, just one of these annoying little differences in syntax. But logically, it's doing the same thing. It's explicitly putting into the state table any of our outbound traffic. Here we're saying strictly for UDP, though, because for TCP, we've already got this rule that's going to take care of our traffic in both directions. And then finally, here's a rule that's denying everything that we haven't allowed above. All right, so that's what that looks like. So as you can see, it's very similar in functionality to IP filter. The state table, again, works very similarly. You explicitly have to tell it what you're putting into the state table. It has to match one of your rules. And then whatever's in that state table is going to be used to match against the traffic as well. Similarly, it doesn't handle broadcasts, so we've got the same limitations with this as we had with the other one. Oh yeah, as I mentioned, the direction is actually an option in this case, so you can have a single rule that matches traffic in both directions. Ranges and lists are allowed for IP addresses and ports using a much more straightforward notation than in IP filter. So I thought that was one nice little bonus. If you're going to set up a set of rules, I would suggest starting with the GUI at least and then tweaking things manually. So here's what the GUI looks like in 10.3. It's under System Preferences. There's a sharing icon that lets you access that. That sharing icon has three different tabs. One of them is basically for enabling and disabling network services on this machine. And then there's the firewall tab, where you've got a button for starting and stopping the firewall. And then there's a list of the services and the port numbers or port ranges that are going to be basically opened. The curious thing about it is these checkboxes, you'd be very tempted to click on these to enable and disable them. Unfortunately, you can't. This is a read-only list. You actually go to the services, enable and disable the service, and then these will basically just track that. So the weird... it's counterintuitive. Yeah, and the other weird thing is it's kind of an all or nothing. So if you don't have the service enabled, it's not going to open a hole in the firewall. If you have the service enabled, then it opens a hole in the firewall for the whole world. So yeah, it's you don't really have anything in between. So this is where you might want to, like I said, use the GUI to get an initial set of rules, but then go in and start tweaking things manually, because you might want to allow a service only to machines on your subnet, but not to the rest of the world, that sort of thing. Also, where my little ghost cursor is over there, this is where you would find a button called Advanced starting in 10.4. And that would let you do things... there's a few extra options like to allow logging, to allow something called stealth mode, which affects the way it's going to handle ICMP traffic. And there's another rule for blocking UDP traffic as well. 10.5, they decided for some reason to put it in a completely different location. Still under System Preferences, but it's now under the security icon. Once again, you've got several tabs, and there's a firewall tab. Here's the new dumbed-down interface. And I haven't really tried it under 10.5, so I don't know much about how it works. But I would guess that when you say allow all incoming connections, that's like stopping the firewall. When you say allow only essential services, it's starting the firewall, but you're restricted to the list of services that you've actually activated. And that's probably still in the same old place under system preferences sharing. So now you not only have to go to two separate tabs on the same widget, but... Okay. Thank you. I didn't realize that. Okay. So never mind what I said there. Yeah. And I haven't looked at what this does here, but I guess this is where you can then sort of tweak this list and... okay. All right. Anyway, here's a much more complicated GUI, but much more useful. This is under 10.5 server. The next few slides I'm going to talk about is really related to macOS 10 server, as opposed to the regular workstation configuration. And so it's under the server admin application. This is where you would administer a lot of your services, enable and disable them. You've got this little firewall button, and then you get all of this over here. There's a button at the bottom to start and stop the firewall. You can view your logs. You can look at your active rules, and that lets you view the hit counts. It lets you view the list of dynamic rules, like the stuff matching the state table. And then there's this tab here for settings, which gives you all of these tabs. Under address groups, you can specify ranges of addresses. I'm going to demo this one if I have time later, because it's a little hard to see from a static image what's going on. But it would let you specify address ranges, which you then can select from this pull-down menu. And then you can set up what you're going to allow or block for that particular address range. So finally, this one gives you the flexibility you need. It turns out that for one of our macOS servers, I was able to do just about everything I needed right through the GUI. I then had to set up two manual override rules in another config file to do things that I couldn't do through the GUI. So I thought that was pretty good. It let me get 95% of the way there. And you can then set logging options, and advanced lets you do a few other fancy things, which I might have time to demo later. Okay, so like I said, I would recommend you use the GUI to get yourself started. Essentially, whenever you set up those firewall rules, it's going to write a file called etc.ipfilter, ipfw.conf.apple. So all the ones that you're specifying through the GUI go into this file, .apple. Your manual overrides, put them in a separate file, otherwise you'll lose them the next time you use the GUI, because it just does a complete overwrite of this file. It's also the easiest way to start and stop the firewall daemon is through the GUI. There are command line options for starting and stopping services under macOS, but you don't have to go there. I've never done it myself, so I couldn't even tell you exactly what the command line is. And so yeah, like I said, put your overrides in there. After you've done a file change, if you don't want to go back to the GUI just to force a reload, that you can do easily through the command. Just flush the previous rule set and then load each of your config files in sequence. All right. Similarly to ipfilter, there's ways of viewing your hit counts. This will essentially show you the list of rules, but with the hit count information. It gives you packet and byte counts. If you want to see the dynamic state table stuff as well, that's the D option. The minus E will show you the expired ones as well, in case you're interested in seeing that. Logging is handled through a standard log file, so if you want to see your latest log entries, you can just tail that file or just view it with your favorite file viewer. Yep.
You know,
dynamically, the system doesn't change the rule numbers. Once you specify them, they stay there. The GUI will change the rule numbers. It could be, if you have to exactly match, but they're set up sort of in sections as well. So you might find a place where it's safe to put it in. Some of my override rules, they were actually, it was for handling broadcasts. And so it was the counterpart rule. Through the GUI, you could specify the rule for the inbound traffic, but I needed a matching rule going the other way. And so I matched the port number. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not strictly necessary. It'll probably still do the right thing, even if the rule numbers get changed. But yeah, I guess the idea is do your overrides after you've kind of decided this is the way things are going to be. But yeah, they will change if you start enabling or disabling other services in there. Yeah, so here are a few handy links. Again, starting with the Wikipedia thing. A very useful how-to that I found. This was, again, just sort of a sample set of rules that I was able to use just for information. But actually, the rules that I got from out of the GUI were quite useful. If you're stuck with a limited GUI that you don't like, there's a third-party one called Waterroof that is available for macOS. I haven't tried it, but apparently it's one of the most highly recommended ones for macOS. So that's there if you want to use it. And if you're really interested in something like this for Windows, this is the Windows one. Okay, I'm going to try and pick up the pace here. Netfilter IP tables is actually the one that I'm probably the most familiar with. I've been using it for a number of years, and I learned the IP tables one, sorry, the IP filter for Solaris just within the last couple months. Actually, some of you probably saw my posting to the roundtable, which was just after last month's meeting when I asked the question here and didn't get a response. And that was, I was trying to find a way around those weird restrictions in the state table stuff. And as I discovered, there is no workaround other than ugly kludges. And so, my knowledge of those other two firewalling systems is basically limited to what I've learned in the last couple of months. Whereas this, I've actually been working with it for a few years. But still, what I know is just kind of scratching the surface. This is by far the most complicated of the three systems that I'll be talking about tonight. Netfilter is actually a replacement for the older IP chains thing. IP chains was a stateless system in earlier versions of the Linux kernel. But starting with the Linux 2.4 kernel sometime around the year 2000, 2001, this came in. And it maintains state information, and it also does related connection tracking, which is something the other two that I talked about didn't do. You can put filter rules on predefined chains for input, output, and something called forward. And that's if you've got a box with multiple interfaces that's acting as a router. It actually has separate queues for the traffic. This is going to get even more complicated, so I'm going to get to a few diagrams soon that will hopefully help clarify things. Now, unlike the other two systems where you've got one linear list of rules and all your traffic has to go through the whole list until it finds a match, with this, you actually specify chains of rules. And you can add your own user-specified chains, which are kind of like subroutines. And the idea with that is, well, like a subroutine, you can have a set of rules that you will call from multiple different locations. So it's a way of grouping commonality. But it's also a way of doing things a little bit more efficiently than going through one large linear list. What you can do is sort of some crude matching and then call another chain that will then do more detailed matching for that type of traffic. But if you don't match the rule that branches to that, then you don't have to go through all these other rules. So it's a way of kind of, rather than just a linear list, you've got kind of a more arbitrary tree structure of rules. And so you can make your search through the list of rules more efficient that way. And in addition to these chains, there's other table and chain names that let you do more complex operations, such as NAT support is built into this. And so I've probably thoroughly confused you now. So let's just hopefully clarify things a little bit, or this might just confuse things even more. This is my second favorite packet traversal diagram for IP filter, or for net filter IP tables. Yeah, by the way, the reason there's those two names is the kernel module, the whole system is called net filter. IP tables is the command that you end up using to interact with that. And so people will use those terms interchangeably, and it really all does apply to the same system, but it's kind of those two parts. Net filter is what's going on in the kernel. IP tables is the command interface. So here's our packet traversal in its most basic form. Packet comes in from the network. It's available to a chain. This is the raw table, the pre-routing chain. Then it goes to the mangle table pre-routing chain, then the NAT table pre-routing chain. And finally, after going through those three chains, a routing decision is made. The decision is this packet meant for this machine locally, or is it meant to be forwarded on to some other machine? So if it's forwarded, the traffic goes this way, goes through a couple more chains, the mangle table forward chain, the filter forward chain, and then finally it goes out through these. If the traffic is meant for the local machine, it goes through the mangle input chain, the filter input chain, finally goes to a local process, which will probably then generate some output traffic, which will go through a routing decision, and then go through all of these chains on the way out. Okay, this is a lot of potential places to tie into this system. Why would you need all of that? This diagram doesn't necessarily make that clear. It also doesn't make clear the concept of tables versus chains, because all we're seeing is all these different connection points over here. That's why this is my second favorite diagram. My favorite diagram is this one. The only thing missing on this one is they don't have the raw table. The raw table actually is closely connected to ContRack over here. This is for the connection tracking, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more later. That's what lets you do all kinds of fancy tracking of related connections on different ports. And that is kind of built into the kernel. You use kernel modules that will track these connections for you. But the raw table essentially hooks in just before that at these two points, and it lets you manipulate the traffic, if needs be, before it's going to be looked at by the connection tracking modules. So under normal uses, you would never use the raw table. It's only if you need to do tweaks somehow to the traffic that the connection tracking modules are going to see. The mangle table happens over here after connection tracking has happened, and it's available on all the chains. It's the only one that's available on all the chains. And again, it's for doing fairly low-level esoteric stuff. So for most typical applications, you can ignore that table as well. The NAT table has three chains it ties into. Pre-routing chain, which is early in the flow of traffic for incoming packets. Post-routing, which is kind of the last point you hit before the traffic goes out on the network. And output over here, which is for locally generated output traffic. And typically, you're only going to tie into those chains if you're doing specific rules for NAT, which is network address translation. If you're not doing NAT, you can ignore this whole table. So the only one I'm really going to be concerned with in the rest of this presentation is the filter table. And the filter table is where you would do your basic firewall filtering. And so the three points you tie into, the three chains, are input and output, which is, again, conceptually similar to what we've seen in the previous firewalling systems. The difference now is that the Linux kernel breaks the traffic flow into these two paths here, depending on what kind of packet it is. The input chain is really only for packets that are meant for local programs. Okay, so that's input to this machine. All right. If the traffic is being forwarded, it goes to a separate chain, and it never makes it to the input chain. So this chain, we're only going to worry about if we're setting up a router box. If we've just got a box with one interface to the outside world, typically we can ignore it again. So we're back down to two points of connection, just like in the previous firewall systems. Okay, just one more quick thing about user-specified chains. Remember I mentioned it's kind of like subroutines? This is kind of an illustration of that. So you've got this chain over here. Let's say it's your input chain. You will have a sequence of rules in here, and you keep going through until one of the rules tells you to jump somewhere else. Okay. Now that jump can be to a predefined target, or it can be to a user-defined chain. So when you jump to a user-defined chain, it's kind of like a subroutine. You go through those rules. When you fall through the end of this chain, you basically go back to where you were and to the rule after that, and you just continue your flow of control through there. Okay? So when you're jumping, it's essentially like a subroutine call, and you can nest these multiple levels deep. And the return happens implicitly when you hit the end without matching or without jumping to somewhere else. You can also jump to a particular predefined target called return, which just forces a return from the chain you're in to where you were called from. Okay? Make sense? Haven't lost anyone yet? Good. All right. This is where I lose you, maybe. All right, so here's what our command syntax looks like to basically define these. And again, this is a very simplified version. That's true for the other systems too, by the way. If you go to their man pages, you'll see that the syntax, if you look at it in all its gory details, is more complicated than what I showed you. I showed you essentially the essential basic stuff you need to know to get going. The more esoteric stuff you can look at on your own later. So you have the IP tables command. You can optionally specify a table either with a short option or a long option, so minus T or minus minus table. That's true for most of the options in IP tables. There's the long keyword options and the short single character options. For most of what I'm going to show after, I'm just going to use the short options where possible, just for the sake of space on the slides. But if you like to have things more verbose and descriptive, just so it makes more sense when you go back to read it later, by all means use the long options. So if you want to set up a new chain, one of these little subroutines, you would use that option. Each chain, each of the predefined chains, not the ones you define yourself, they also have this thing called a policy, which is essentially the default action. And that's essentially what happens if you hit the end of that chain. Okay, the user-defined chains, when you hit the end, you return to where you were called from. But if you're in one of those predefined chains, well, there's nowhere to return to from where you were called. You have to make a decision at that point. What are you going to do with this packet? That's where the policy comes in. So it's, like I said, it's a default action. And so when you specify a policy, the target you specify has to be one of these predefined ones. You can't specify a user-specified chain there. And then here's your kind of meat and potatoes command. This is how you're going to add rules. You can either add them to the end of a chain, or you can insert them at the very start of a chain. Or it turns out, I didn't show it in this example, but with insert you can put a sequence number, and it's going to put it at that point in the existing chain. So you can actually do insertions in the middle of an existing chain. I've never really seen a need for that. Typically, those two options let you do what you need. If it's more complicated than that, typically you're flushing your rules and starting over anyway. Okay, and then you do this thing called a rule specification, and then you might have some options after. Your rule specification is the main thing that is going to do matching against the packets. So these are all options that you can specify or can leave out. You can specify a protocol, and that's going to be, again, TCP, UDP, ICMP. Source and destination, address, you can also put a mask. And an interface, and there you specify either an input interface or an output interface. When I first looked at that, I thought, well, why do you need two options to do that? Well, it's, again, because of all those different chains you can tie into. If you're in the input chain or the output chain, it's kind of obvious what interface you're talking about, maybe, right? Or at least the direction of the interface. But if you're in the forward chain, you might want to match against a particular input interface or a different output interface. So that's why they have two options there. And then finally, you specify a jump target, which, as I said before, can be one of your user-defined chains as a subroutine or one of these. Your basic matching is about as simple as this. Protocol addresses. Notice what's missing in here? Ports. Yeah. Okay. It turns out anything fancier you want to do, and you can get really fancy, is done with a particular set of modules. So all the fancier extended packet matching is done through these modules. If you want to do matching on port numbers, there's a module for TCP that you can load in that then does source port or destination port matching. This is the long format for the option. You can also say sport. And likewise here, you could say destination hyphen port, or you can say dport. There's likewise a UDP module, which has those same options, so you can do the matching on those. And there's tons and tons of different modules that let you do all kinds of fancy matching. I'm not really going to get into many of those other than the state module, which I'll cover in just a second. And then finally, for your jump target, your targets, as I said, are a user-specified chain or one of these. Now, it turns out the basic ones here, accept, drop, and return, I guess are fairly intuitive for accept and drop. Accept says, yeah, we're going to take this packet. Drop says, we're just going to throw the packet away. It's going to go no further than that. Return is just for flow control in the chains. Okay, it doesn't say anything about what you're doing to the packet. It's just saying you're returning from that chain. Reject and log, and there's a whole bunch of other targets. Those are actually parts of extended modules as well. So even your targets is extendable through a modular system. So the whole IP tables thing, it just gets more complex. You think you've got it figured out, and someone adds another module, and there's all kinds of new functionality. So it's kind of like, you know, peeling another layer off the onion, and you never really get to the core of it. All right. So once you've specified a bunch of these rules through the command line, obviously you're not going to want to do this every time. I mean, you can set up scripts, and a lot of people do that. They just set up a shell script with all of their IP tables commands, and that's their whole set of firewall rules. But it turns out there's also ways of saving and restoring the list of rules that you've already defined through individual commands. And so you can just save that to a file, and then later you can restore it from that file. And I'll just skip the oops. Now again, it's a little daunting to start, so you might want to start with a GUI. This is the one that comes with Fedora. This screenshot is actually from Fedora 10, so this is the latest version of this. So under the system menu, under administration, there's firewall. And once you get that going, you get this little firewall configuration GUI. There's a wizard you can go through that will basically just ask you a few questions, and then it'll give you one of a few stock configurations. There's a configuration for servers, there's a configuration for workstations, and I don't remember what else. But yeah, you basically just sort of pick a stock configuration. This was the workstation configuration. And so then you then go through the list of services and you can enable and disable things. And so I basically just took the stock configuration and I added SSH. I said I want to allow SSH in there. And then I basically saved my rules. And this is what it generated, a file called etc. sysconfig IP tables. And here in a nutshell are my rules. Okay, so some of this will perhaps seem intuitive and based on what we saw in the previous slides might make sense to you already. Some of it is not. It's kind of cryptic shorthands. What these three lines do is define for three of your predefined chains, input, forward, and output, what your default policy is. And so for all three of these, it's saying that the policy or the default action is to accept the packets. So that means if we don't do anything else, the traffic is going to go through. So most of our rules now here are going to either explicitly accept traffic or reject it. Okay. And in this case, we went fairly simple. This is what the GUI generated. It just directly applied these to the input chain. We're not doing any user-defined chains. We're not doing anything for output, so it's just everything on the output side is going to be accepted. For forwarding, we've got one rule here that says we're rejecting everything. There's nothing else in the forward chain. So essentially, this won't work on a multi-homed host. Won't work on any server with multiple interfaces, won't work on a router, but you would obviously have picked a different set of rules for those cases. Draw your attention now to this one over here, because there's a couple little subtle things going on here. First of all, this is that state module I alluded to before. Okay, so this says load the state module, and if our packet has the state established or related, we'll accept it. What does that mean? Established is kind of like our state table in the two earlier firewall systems. Okay, basically that says if this is part of an established flow, let the traffic through. So we won't go any further down the chain in those cases. This, we're not specifying a protocol. So this particular established state actually works for TCP, it works for UDP, and it even works for ICMP. And if you go through one of the tutorials on IP tables, they give you all kinds of scenarios for that and explains for each of those types of protocols what established means. Okay, it gets a little subtle, but just suffice it to say, it's saying this is part of a connection we've already started somewhere. So we're just going to let the rest of it go through. Related, this is a new concept. This is what I was talking about before, about connections on other ports that are related to the connection that we had already established. Okay, and that's where those connection tracking modules come in. All right. And so they will set that state on the traffic. And so that will then allow it through. The other thing that's different about this approach to the state table compared to the two previous firewall systems, with those systems, you had to specify in your rules explicitly that you wanted the state information kept. If you didn't, nothing went into the state table. The matching against the state table happened implicitly. Okay, here it's the other way around. If you want to match things in the state table, you explicitly state what your intention is. But there's nowhere where you tell it to save stuff in the state table. All of that happens implicitly for all of your traffic. Okay, and then the rest of this is just matching particular protocol types. We're saying we're going to allow all ICMP traffic in. We're going to allow everything on the loopback in. These two protocols are related to IPsec. I don't particularly know what it's about, so I won't get into it. The rest of these rules are essentially, it's combining matching against state as well as matching other characteristics of the packets. So the only thing we're matching as far as the state is the state called new here. Okay, so this says basically this is a brand new packet that's not related to anything we've seen before. Okay, typically it's because we're on the input queue, this is an incoming request to this machine. All right, so then we can match further against things like the UDP protocol or the TCP protocol, and we can specify source addresses and ports, destination addresses and ports. So what this rule essentially is doing is it's saying we're going to allow multicast DNS, which is going to be on this destination port to this multicast address. So we're going to accept all multicast DNS. We're going to accept 631, I believe, is IPP, which is Internet Printing Protocol. Yeah. Actually, if I just go back. No, I was probably earlier on the list. Can't see it there. Yeah. Yeah. 37 and 38, we've actually seen those before. Those are related to Samba, to specifically to the NetBIOS name service. All right. And finally there, this is for our SSH. So essentially everything that got spit out here was part of its stock configuration. The only tweak I did by adding one checkbox for SSH was I got this rule added to the list. Now, anything that doesn't match these is going to get rejected, and it's rejecting it with an ICMP host prohibited message. So essentially traffic is going to be going back to the machine that tried to contact us, and it's going to say the host has prohibited traffic to that particular destination address and port. Okay, and so that's basically it. All right. I mentioned connection tracking. It's done with kernel modules that you have to explicitly load based on what kinds of traffic you want to do connection tracking on. Okay, so for instance, if I'm running an FTP server, I want to load this module in. If I'm running Samba, I want to load this module in. And so yeah, this is the way you would do it manually through a command, mod probe. On Red Hat or Fedora systems, there's an easier way to do it. Just put it in iptables-config under the etc. sysconfig directory. There's a variable, which is basically just a list of space-separated module names. And so you just put them in the list there. If you're running an Amanda backup server, you put the IP contract hyphen Amanda module in there as well. And those are the only three that I use on any of our servers. And it turns out there's other modules for all of these other protocols I mentioned at the start. So if you're running a SIP server, there's a module for that. So if you want to enable this service, again, you can do it through the GUI. That's the way I did it for this example here. And so, yeah, you can go through the configuration wizard or through the menus under the options menu. You can load a default configuration, and it gives you several stock scenarios that you can start with. And then you basically just go through your list of trusted services and check services off if you don't want them, check them on if you do, and you can enable, disable the service. Finally, once you've got that done, you may want to do some manual tweaking by editing those things. The iptables config file is where you're going to do your connection tracking modules, as I just said. And then your iptables rules will go into there. After you've made changes, you can do service iptables restart, but that's very drastic. Actually, what it does is it does a complete unload. It unloads all your firewall rules. It flushes all the chains, deletes any of the user-defined chains, unloads all of your connection tracking modules, and then reloads them all in the reverse order. The problem with doing that, if you're doing it on a busy system, is a lot of your state information gets wiped out. And so guess what? Connections that you had already authorized and might still be going are suddenly being blocked. So I discovered the hard way that if you're going to make some minor tweaks to this file and you want to reload it without unloading your connection tracking modules, You can do it this way. Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep, yeah. But I sort of, in most of the machines I've set up, I used the GUI only initially to get the rules set up. And then I did a lot of hand editing to this. And I didn't want to just wipe that out. I mean, yeah, I could have done it through the save and the restore. But I found that in some cases, the way it wrote out the rules, like the format of it wasn't as obvious as what I had written. So I'm just a stickler for things like that. So, yeah. So this was my way of doing it manually. Okay. If you want to monitor things, with the save command, there's a minus C option that will show you the counts. And it gives you both the packet and the byte count. So you could save that to a file, or you can just view it on the screen. So this will give you a dump of all your current rules with all the packet counts. So you can just view that as useful information. Logging is done through syslog. So on a Red Hat or Fedora system, it'll be under var log messages. So you can just grep for kernel messages at the tail end of that file or whatever. It's just a text file. You do whatever you want with it. Connection tracking information. Under the proc file system, you can actually get a list of all the state table, essentially, all the connection tracking information. It's a very long list, and it's a very obscure format, but potentially useful if you're trying to debug something. Little word of caution. The module names have changed somewhere in the 2.6 kernel version tree. I've got some 2.6 point whatever systems where the names are IP contract, and that's the names under this procnet file system, but also the names of the modules that get loaded. You can still do mod probe on the old name, like IP underscore contract underscore FTP, but if you then do an ls mod, you'll see that the actual module that's loaded is nf underscore contract underscore FTP. Yeah, that's true for the matching modules, like that state module, and there's a whole bunch of others. Those will get loaded as they're required. But for the connection tracking modules, at least on Red Hat and Fedora systems, you have to specify them somewhere, otherwise they don't get loaded. Because you don't specify it directly in your IP table's rules. So, yeah, you have to specify it somewhere if you want it loaded. Okay? There. Okay. We're really running late, so I'm just going to go through this very quickly. This is actually just a fancier example using some other modules. There's a module called Recent that lets you do tracking of recent packets from a particular, matching particular criteria. And a few months back, actually, I think it was sometime last year, I wrote up an article in the Mug newsletter about this feature. And so this is just sort of, in a nutshell, the rules that you would use for matching. And essentially what it's to do is, everyone gets annoyed with these script kiddies that start probing with SSH and try with exhaustive lists of users and user IDs and passwords against your system. And of course, it just starts filling your log files with all of these failed requests. So this is a way, basically, of limiting the number of incoming connections you're going to allow to any port. In this example, I'm using SSH. And it will track them, okay? So basically, if a particular address is sending more ports, more connection requests to a particular port that exceeds the hit count you specified for a particular window of time that you've specified, then you can do things like drop them or reject them, log them, and so on. So in this example, what I'm doing is saying, if anyone is requesting 8 or more connections to SSH within a 60-second window, just drop those packets. This is clearly someone who is just running SSH probes. If they are not quite at that count yet, if they're doing four or more, but less than eight within that same 60-second window, then we're going to log it as a rejection. And here we will reject it. So this is essentially the same rule applied twice, but with just different jump targets. This is just to the log target, just to force a log entry. And then we do the same match again, and then we jump to reject. Okay. So in this case, we're rejecting with a TCP reset. And so essentially, they're going to get a connection refused. So this at least gives people a warning that this is going to happen. So if it's just someone who's like running a script that's going to do several SSH commands, they'll start to get errors before they hit this upper bound, where then things are just going to bog down because they're never going to get any traffic back telling them what's happening. Their packets are just being thrown away at that point. Yeah. And anything less than those four per 60-second window, we're just going to accept them. So whole bunch of resources here. Just go quickly through a few of them that I found very useful. This tutorial, very, very useful. This site here has the tutorial formatted slightly differently, plus a few other little interesting articles. A lot of the diagrams that I grabbed for this presentation were actually from that site. And each of those diagrams, I'm going to have this presentation available on the website. Each of those diagrams is a link to the appropriate section in there. That other diagram, my favorite diagram that showed the flow of control through all those tables and chains, that's from this site over here. This was a tutorial on doing some more fancy things with firewalls, including advanced routing stuff. If you want a GUI, this isn't a GUI. This was kind of cool. This was a website that you can go to, EasyFWGen, and just through a set of online forms, you can specify everything you want to allow or not allow. And it goes through several scenarios, and depending on what you filled in on that form, you might get a few follow-up screens with other forms. And eventually, it spits out an init script, which contains a whole bunch of IP table commands. So if you're not happy with the GUIs that are available and you want to just generate a firewall an easy way, this is kind of a good way to get started. And since it's just a shell script that it spits out, it's easy to tweak it manually after that. Finally, this is the Muglines article I was just referring to with the SSH probe hack. This is the site where I got the initial idea from, and I just did some minor tweaks to it. And finally, this I just discovered in that latest Linux journal that we're going to be giving away today. They had just in a little sidebar somewhere, they've got a video tutorial on IP tables, and it's in three parts. So this is part one, it's actually an I, two, and then the final installment. Very useful to go through. If you're going to go through parts two and the final installment, have one of those diagrams that I showed you handy, because they're going to go through this chain, but they're going to do it sort of in a linear sequence, and it's hard to know exactly where it all fits in. They also do, in part two, they do some NAT filtering. And so if you've got that diagram handy, one of those two diagrams handy, it'll really help you to understand the flow of control as you're watching the video. So just, you know, have it either in another window beside or have a printed copy handy in front of you. There we go. Finally, after all that, are there any questions? Okay. Yeah. Okay, if I understand the question, you want to firewall not at the Windows box itself, but on your Linux box, you want to firewall the crap you're seeing from the Windows boxes? Or, okay, right. Right, yeah. Well, actually, I think that would be a good way to do it, especially if you don't know ahead of time what kind of traffic you can expect to see. Where firewalls work very well is if you know what kind of traffic you want to allow, and that's a very limited and controlled set of ports. Then it's easy to specify in your firewall rules, I want to block everything I don't know, and I want to allow only these particular incoming ports, right? And so that's one way of doing it. If, however, what the scenario you're seeing is you don't know necessarily ahead of time everything you want to allow as incoming traffic, but you're seeing something coming in that is to a particular known port and you don't want to allow that, then you can set up a default policy to accept everything, but then put in rules to just reject particular traffic that matches that pattern that you know ahead of time. Yeah, yeah. Most of the security tutorials you read, I mean, most of them are written by people who are, you know, people whose main area is security, and most of them tend to be a little bit on the paranoid side. And they tend to advocate, as a default policy, deny everything, okay? And then only accept traffic that you know is something you want to deal with. Pardon me? Well, actually, they would advocate both. They would say deny incoming, deny outgoing, and then just... Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's another approach. You can have firewalls running on each of your machines. And if the Windows boxes are the problem, you can put firewall software on those. And as Kelly said, restrict traffic in both directions except for known ports. It may be a pain initially when you're configuring it because you're going to keep getting these pop-ups and you have to keep allowing things. But over time, that should stabilize and you should see fewer of those except for actual, you know, bad traffic that you want to deny. Question back there? By origin of application, I'm not sure what... Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. That's a good question. I know there's one that works only on the output chain, which you can match against a user ID on that system. And so for obvious reasons, it only works on the output chain. But... I don't know if there's any way of tracking it to a particular, in this case, it would be like a particular process or a particular program image that a process is running. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't come across anything like that, but that's not to say it's not out there. It certainly wasn't, I can't remember seeing anything like that documented in the IP tables man page, but there might be some third-party modules out there that are not necessarily in the standard documentation. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it turns out earlier versions of OpenBSD, I discovered this just as I was researching this presentation, they ran IP filter, and then starting with OpenBSD 3.0, I think they went with the PF system. Yeah, so it's kind of based on that because it was an offshoot of that. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, I didn't get into that because I already had more than enough for one presentation here. And PF was covered, actually, by Sean Walbridge at a previous meeting, but that was many years ago. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.